Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, back after Todd Zwillick so ably held down the fort here for a few days. Anticipation is our theme today. Immigrants await the president's decision to unilaterally help unauthorized immigrants, millions of them perhaps. The people of Missouri await the results of a grand jury deliberation on the police shooting in Ferguson and all the violence this summer, and a remembrance of director Mike Nichols, who died yesterday. 83 grand years of life. We can never repay him for all the brilliant, funny, wonderful moments on stage and screen. Also this hour, African musicians mobilized to raise the spirits and deliver important messages to people in the middle of the Ebola crisis. But first, the president says he plans to change the status of an estimated 5 million undocumented people living in this country. According to the White House, the president's plan would prevent the deportation of as many as 4 million undocumented immigrants if they have lived here for 5 years and have no criminal record. An additional 1 million will be granted protection through additional unspecified parts of the president's order. But one blow to immigration advocates, the parents of dreamers, those who fall under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, will not be granted deportation reprieve. Republicans are up in arms over this announcement, with some of the far right calling for impeachment and more moderate voices claiming the president is overreaching. For a few minutes today, we want to put aside the politics and talk about how this executive order works in practice. On the line is Myra Rubio Limon, an undocumented immigrant who was brought to the U.S. as a child. She receives protection from deportation under DACA, and it looks like her parents will not be a part of the 5 million to remain here legally. Myra, what's your reaction to all of this?
Like you said, John, it's a blow because we have been fighting for this for so long, but just the fact that President Obama is going to make an announcement shows that if we keep fighting, we can reach what we want.
And did you expect that your parents might be included here?
You know what? I did. We don't know exactly what the announcement is going to be, but this is what we're fighting for. You know, they are the original dreamers. They came before us, and they are the reason we keep on fighting. We want something for our parents. We want something for the dreamers who were left out in the first time. We want something for those people who are working hard every day. And yes, I do want my parents to be included, as well as the parents of the other members or my brothers and sisters in our organization.
Also with us is Cyrus Mehta, who's an immigration attorney here in New York. Cyrus, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you, John.
So what would be the difference between Myra's parents and the people who fall under this classification of having been here in the United States for 5 years unauthorized without a criminal record?
We're still waiting for the details to come out. But what we've heard so far is that only the parents of U.S. citizen children or lawful permanent residents will get this reprieve. These are the 4 million parents who are likely to get the reprieve. And therefore, Myra's parents, who are the parents of a DACA recipient, may not be included. But again, we don't have the details. There may be other forms of relief that might become available. So it's basically waiting to see with great anticipation.
And you're an immigration lawyer, not a constitutional lawyer. Do you think the omission of Myra's parents might have to do with the president's sense of his constitutional limits or his political limits, or this is just something he's not allowed to do?
The president has broad discretion with respect to immigration matters, particularly with regards to whom he wants to remove from the United States. And this is essentially a political decision. It's highly controversial. He's pushed this through. And in order for it to be palatable, it probably makes more political sense, at least from his perspective, to limit it to parents of U.S. citizen children or lawful permanent residents. But again, we don't have the details. There might be other reprieves for parents of DACA recipients. I believe it should be as broad as possible.
So how did DACA change your life, Myra? And help me to understand, and for our listeners to understand, how you and your family have really followed all the rules with the exception of crossing a border.
So I graduated in 2009 from South Dade Senior High School. And at that moment in my life, I did not want to pursue a higher education just for the fact that I knew I wasn't going to be able to do much because of the high cost of going to school and because I didn't have a social to get a job. So when DACA came out, it changed my life completely. I am now able to have a driver's license. I am driving with no fear, knowing that I am not at risk of deportation. I am now able to attend Miami-Dade College. I can help my family in so many more ways. And, you know, this is really life-changing. I'm out of the shadows. I can publicly say I am not afraid. I can go to work. I am a member of society that I know I'm working hard for what I want. And, you know, this is something that is going to help everyone so much, just for the fact that you have people who are even afraid when they're walking down the street and they see a police officer, they turn the other way. That is not what America is about. That is not what we want for our community.
All right. What Myra describes here is that the principles of DACA allow her to help her parents, even though they remain unauthorized, in the sense that she doesn't have any fear. She can help to assist them in paperwork and going out and dealing with whatever it is they need to deal with in their lives. Will this executive order create a community of people who no longer have fear of deportation, who can also help family members, who can also be of assistance to people in their own communities?
Absolutely. You know, John, we have a broken immigration system, and it's been broken for more than two decades. And that's the reason why we have such a buildup of undocumented people. And this executive policy will allow millions of people to come out of the woodwork and live normal lives, as Myra just described. It's going to be wonderful for these people. And this is just a step in the right direction. It's not going to be perfect. But we had DACA in 2012, which was limited to a small group of people. Now we have a broader group of people. And as more and more people come out of the woodwork, get legalized, and become part of America and this great country and the dream, they will be able to push for greater relief. Ultimately, we need Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform. The president can only do so much through an executive order, but we need to have Congress to pass a law that would fix the whole problem and solidify the status of these people and many more.
Anticipating people who will be coming to your office to figure out what the heck's the deal here, what sort of paperwork do people like this have to carry? Do DACA recipients and DACA beneficiaries carry something, you know, like a green card to indicate that they are not deportable based on their status right now? What'll it be, a yellow card, a red card, a...
It might just be an approval letter along with a worker authorization document.
So you have to carry with you at all times.
It would probably be preferable, but even if you don't carry the work authorization document, they can look you up in the system and see you're an approved beneficiary of this program. But before people get there, they will have to establish that they meet the criteria. And this is a discretionary program. The folks who are going to apply and who have to establish eligibility have to show that they've otherwise been of good moral character, they've not been convicted of crimes. There will be these criteria. And they will also have to establish that they have lived here for 5 years through tax returns, through rent receipts, through bank statements, and other documentation.
Now, are these people potential political targets if the Congress wants to reverse what the president has done and said all those people who got those papers, who went down and signed up for all this stuff and submitted all of their records and that the government knows exactly where they are, these people get out tomorrow?
That is theoretically possible, but whether in practical terms that would ever happen is unlikely. It's a risk worth taking because when millions come forward, I can't see any Congress taking it away because it would be politically problematic for that Congress and for the future of that party if they want to win elections.
Myra, let's go back to your very first memories of when you heard about DACA and the feeling that you had and what unauthorized immigrants here in the United States might be feeling about this executive order we're going to hear about later today?
I think fear is always going to be there, especially because you know that there is a slight possibility that this can be taken away. And even though I was fearful when the announcement came out, I have nothing more to lose. I was already here without a status, and I am without a status because this is just a work permit. But, you know, to the people who might benefit from this, I say this is an opportunity to grow, an opportunity to pursue your dreams. And yes, it is scary, but it is also worth it. It's life-changing. And I was very afraid, but at the end of the day, I felt like I had nothing to lose, and it was either all or nothing.
From Homestead, Florida, Myra Rubio-Limon is speaking to us, an undocumented immigrant, a beneficiary of DACA, even though her parents won't be. Myra, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Cyrus Madoff, before we go, what Obama is doing tonight is nothing new, right? There have been amnesties and unilateral actions from other presidents.
Sure. President Reagan, as well as the first President Bush, did something quite similar. After the first amnesty was announced in 1986, their family members were left out of the legislation. So both Presidents Reagan and Bush passed executive orders that allowed family members to stay in the United States just like this with work authorization. And what was remarkable is that ultimately the U.S. Congress incorporated this executive order into law. And that's historically been the case.
The crazy way we try to fix our broken immigration system.
And even with DACA, you know, the Senate bill that got passed last year, which the House has not taken up, incorporated DACA into the legislation.
So presidents acting laterally, Congress picks up the slack later on, but it's still a system that's broken. Cyrus, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having
me. Cyrus Smeda is an immigration attorney, and we earlier spoke with Myra Rubio-Limon, who's an undocumented immigrant in Homestead, Florida. So what do you think?
Tana from Santa Rosa. Just like Lincoln with his Emancipation Proclamation, I believe Obama is finally choosing to help those that the GOP would rather ignore. Education, not deportation.
From Kingston, Massachusetts, I support immigration reform, but I would have liked to see a more cooperative move from the president rather than I'm over here and right and you're all wrong. Doesn't set the table for open negotiations or bode well for any other issues to be talked about and honestly debated. From Ann Arbor, Michigan, yes, I agree with his decision. These people deserve peace of mind. They have lived most of their lives here. They're not taking anything away from the American people, and most of them are very productive members of society. Other presidents have done this, so why shouldn't President Obama? From Huntington, West Virginia, he is a president and not a monarch. I believe we need to secure our southern border before we do anything else, and I think any executive order will be reversed by the next Republican in the White House. Will do more harm than good to the immigration discussion. Call us with your views at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The online taxi service Uber is successful. It's worth more than $18 billion. It operates in more than 200 cities across 45 countries. But it may be eroding its brand and some of that value, that corporate value, by some of its management techniques and some of the ways that it's dealt with the media. Sarah Lacey, a tech reporter for Pando Daily, was singled out as a journalist to target someone who criticized Uber, and it's not the first time the company has come under attack. Uber has gotten in trouble for strong-arming its relationship with drivers, trying to undermine competitors, and for its CEO, Travis Kalanick, making sexist comments. Alyssa Shavinsky is a CTO of Glimpse, a private photo-sharing app. Welcome, Alyssa.
Thank you for having me.
So trying to undermine competitors, that's the American way, right? That's how capitalism works, being tough when you're struggling or when you're just starting out Is Uber's tactics any different from any other ruthless company on the way up?
That's a great question. And some of the companies that end up making the biggest impact are run by ruthless executives. Steve Jobs is a great example of someone who managed to build a really powerful company because he just didn't take no for an answer. But what we're seeing with Uber is Travis really crossing the line and getting a lot of pushback for that. And the danger is that Uber is going to be known not for its excellent service, but for its scandalous business practices.
And what lines would you say that Travis has crossed here?
You know, it's really questionable to go after journalists who are not writing about you in a favorable way. That's really crossing a line. And the attitude towards customers really reflects, well, just a lack of respect for the customers and a general lack of respect for people.
And it also reflects the fact that they have a lot of data on customers, that they can instantly create a different sort of customer experience for someone who tries to hail a cab because they know of certain things that they may have done, criticisms they may have leveled at the company, and can immediately create an experience that's negative for that customer or for that journalist, for that matter.
Their attitude towards data is what's really troubling, and we're seeing a call for them to be more transparent about how they're approaching user data, and we're just not seeing the level of responsibility from the executive team. For example, they have a view called God view, where they can see everything that's happening with all of the riders on the platform, and they've used this to show off to investors the people who are using their service. So for example, if they wanted to, they could show you all the celebrities using their app right now. Now, if I was a high-profile personality, I would be cautious about using Uber, knowing that they might be displaying my whereabouts at any moment if it serves their business purposes. That's not really a responsible way to handle user data.
But it is legal, right?
It's legal, but just because something is legal doesn't mean it's a good user experience.
And I guess, are we going to be seeing more and more of this kind of approach to data as a power for companies to have power over their competitors and, to a certain extent, over their customers? Or do you see Uber being held accountable in some really important way, either by customers or by journalists here? What's going to happen?
We're seeing a tremendous backlash against Uber among the tech community, the tech journalists, the analysts, and the early adopters. It remains to be seen whether this is going to trickle down and have an impact on users. What we are seeing with data consistently is companies acquiring more and more data about users, using that to personalize the experience and make it a better experience for users. Overall, this can be a good thing when it's really aimed at making things better for customers. But what we're seeing with Uber is a lack of respect and consideration for the users. And that's why there's pushback. That's why people are concerned. And it really raises questions about the future of Uber if the conversation that people have isn't about their great service, but is about, you know, whether or not they're reliable, whether we can trust them, whether we feel safe.
In a sense, they're an online monopoly in that they have a huge market share of this online dispatchable taxis, and they have this global reach. Maybe to go back to, you know, old time classical capitalism, maybe they need a little competition here in their own space.
I'd say that's exactly right. And what's interesting about Uber is they've come into a space that was hostile, and the force of Travis's personality and the force of their insistence on pushing through and changing laws has given them access to markets that have been shut off to other companies. For example, you can use Uber in New York City, but Lyft wasn't able to work out a deal with the relevant government agencies and taxi agencies here in New York. So there are companies like Lyft who want to come in and be competitive with Uber, but they just haven't been able to grease the wheels in the same way. Uber's been really successful at coming into markets where other similar companies just haven't been able to get past the red tape. That said, Uber doesn't really have anything so unique or special long term. You know, the drivers are all contractors. Uber doesn't own its vehicles. Customers could switch with the download of an app. So their monopoly seems primarily to be based on their ability to come in and just bulldoze these government restrictions against taxi services.
$18 billion worth of sort of macho dude mentality in the tech world. Maybe that's what we're looking at here at Uber. Alyssa Shavinsky is CTO of Glimpse, a private photo sharing app. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, as Missouri awaits a grand jury decision on the death of Michael Brown, a lack of leadership in the state has one state senator very, very upset.
Honestly, I have to say, every time the governor opens his mouth, he digs a deeper hole.
More from Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal on the failures of Governor Jay Nixon in just a bit.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
In a Democratic seasonal exercise, the New York Times recently assigned each state in the Union and the District of Columbia a Thanksgiving recipe. There are some great recipes in the lineup, of course. D.C. gets garam masala pumpkin tart, a South Asian treat. Idaho gets Hasselback potatoes with garlic paprika oil. That might be expected. New Mexico gets slow-cooked red chili turkey. But the state of Minnesota landed grape salad as its state Thanksgiving recipe. Rachel Hutton is editor-in-chief at the Minnesota Monthly. She's written about food for various Minnesota publications for the last decade. Grape salad, now I'm familiar with grape salad. It's not the most challenging recipe in the world. How do you feel about this, Rachel?
John, I'm impressed that you've heard of grape salad, because everyone else that I've talked to seems to have never heard of it before.
My mother used to make it. She's a Midwesterner.
You know, I'm familiar with kind of a deconstructed version of it, which would be taking the sour cream and the brown sugar that they specified and dipping fruit in it. You could dip grapes in it or strawberries or things like that. But I'd actually never heard of a grape salad. So, you know, I did what I only knew to do, which was called my mother, who is a repository of a bunch of those church basement Lutheran cookbooks. And she actually had heard of grape salad, but a different version of it where you slice the grapes, put them in a baking pan, put the other ingredients on top and broil it.
Oh, my goodness. Now, my mother never broiled it. It was always sliced grapes with some sort of creamy kind of sour cream, mayo sort of sugary thing. And my brother always claimed that the first time he ate that when he was 5 years old, he had a stomach ache ever since. He's still complaining of the same stomach ache. So what's Minnesota going to do about this?
Oh, no. Well, it sounds like a lot of people are up in arms. You know, the Twitterverse is kind of going crazy. There was something in the Star Tribune newspaper this morning sort of about the backlash. But I don't know. I think we maybe should embrace the grape, and maybe people make this recipe for Thanksgiving and enjoy it. Or maybe they'll just stick to their traditional Jell-O salads, you know, which would be kind of, in my mind, more of a sort of Minnesota vernacular
And Jell-O is actually grown in Minnesota. I don't know if grapes are grown in Minnesota, right?
We have a small wine industry. I don't know that they're table grapes, but wine grapes.
Well, let's just say that, you know, we're going to erase this completely from the memory. What is a great, in your view, Minnesota Thanksgiving-style recipe?
I mean, so many ways that you could go, John. But I suppose, you know, the classic, another classic that people think of with Minnesota is, of course, hot dish. Although the thing with hot dish that I think maybe those outside of the Midwest don't understand is that it's not a special thing that you'd have on Thanksgiving. It's more of a Tuesday night kind of thing. So I might actually suggest my mom's turkey hot dish recipe that you use the leftover Thanksgiving turkey for, and you add a can of cream of celery soup, and you crush Ritz crackers on top, put some pats of butter on it, and bake that in the oven, and then you sprinkle poppy seeds on top.
That sounds so completely Minnesota, and even for people who might object to the cheesiness of the Ritz crackers, it's still better than grape salad, right?
Maybe you could have them together. We'll split the difference.
Rachel Hutton is editor-in-chief at Minnesota Monthly. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Objecting to grape salad will save your objections to Thanksgiving when we'll be spending a lot of time with the Sporkful's Dan Pashman, mapping out your best strategy for tackling Thanksgiving, what to cook, when to eat, and how to get the holiday just right. That's all next week on The Takeaway. Mike Nichols, New America. New love and new actors and what they could do better than even they did. He made Dustin Hoffman a star in The Graduate, a movie about love and America.
Robinson, I think you're the most attractive of all my parents' friends.
And here in the film Carnal Knowledge, he made fun of America's sexual revolution and got Jack Nicholson and Art Garfunkel to share the silver screen.
There's a way to talk to girls, you know. Tell her a joke.
What joke?
Tell her about your unhappy childhood.
That's not bad.
But don't make it like an act.
Nichols himself shared the small screen with Elaine May. Nichols and May were a legendary comedy team long before Mike Nichols became known as one of the greatest directors of all time. Here they are back in the 1950s joking about the quiz game scandals.
I see where they've called this little girl to the stand in the quiz scandal.
Oh, yeah, I saw the little girl.
Yeah, terrible thing.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. If they had to fix the little girl...
Yeah, fixed her.
...to rig the quiz...
Yeah.
How did they put it to her? She's nine.
Yeah. I suppose they said, kid...
Yeah.
You want to make some money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, that's how I put it to my child.
Yeah.
Nichols' comedic timing is part of why he was such a genius. The fact that he could do whatever the actors could do. He could read any line, play any part. It was why they so revered him and loved working with him. Here's Dustin Hoffman speaking in 2010 when Mike Nichols received his AFI Life Achievement Award.
God bless you, sir. You're more than a great director. You're a real artist down to your toes because you're insanely courageous. You took a chance on me. You should never have done that. You allowed us to work from ourselves. No one has ever done that before or since. Keep doing it.
And here's Meryl Streep, who he directed in Silkwood.
I started to fall in love with you over and over and over again. No explanation of our world could be complete and no account or image of it so rich if we didn't have you.
Just rattle them off, the hits and the labors of love. Catch 22, Working Girl. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great big fat flop.
Stop it, Mother.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor.
Why is Congress saying one thing and doing nothing?
Well, tradition, mostly.
Charlie Wilson's War, Angels in America, Annie, and then the really wacky stuff, Spamalot and the Birdcage.
Oh, that's nonsense. On a day like this, I'll buy you anything you want.
Anything I want? Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have to change my shoes.
I'll buy you a pair.
I have no pets.
I'll buy you sandals.
Armand!
He died on Wednesday at age 83, having won an Oscar, a Tony, a Grammy, and an Emmy for his work, one of the very few to have ever done that. And he even told a story when he accepted his Tony in 2012 that surprised the audience.
I've been up here before, not at the last year's Tonys, but this was my neighborhood movie theater when I was a kid. And I once won, on a Saturday kids matinee, I won a pie-eating contest. It was nice. But this is nicer. You see before you a happy man. I have to thank Rebecca Miller because she trusted us to do Arthur Miller's greatest play. And I got to do his play, and I got to do it with a cast straight from heaven. Oh, God, I can't talk about them. Like they couldn't... Oh, God. It. Bleep it out. It's very simple. I can't talk about them. I love them too much.
You may be able to bleep out his curses, but there's no way to bleep out the influence of Mike Nichols on entertainment, on America, and in showing us all how to love the work of great art. The Missouri grand jury deliberates, and the people of Ferguson await a decision. Will there be an indictment against Darren Wilson, the police officer who fatally shot unarmed Michael Brown earlier this year?
Let us heal the divisions exposed by the death of Michael Brown and use this defining moment as the moment we begin to walk a different path.
But can Governor Jay Nixon, speaking there, heal anything right now? A state commission's report this week was strongly critical of his decisions in the days after the Michael Brown shooting, and the people of Ferguson will need some convincing if they are to take the governor's plans for responding to the grand jury decision seriously. He certainly didn't help himself here in this conference call with reporters this week.
Given that you've declared the state of emergency, does the buck ultimately stop with you when it comes to how any protests are policed?
Well, honey, our goal here is to keep the peace and allow folks' voices to be heard.
Governor Nixon says declaring a state of emergency even before the grand jury's decision, which is something this Democratic governor has done, is his way to prevent more violence. But Missouri State Democratic Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, who represents the people of Ferguson, says it's another sign the governor just doesn't get what's going on in his own state.
Well, from day one, he basically got caught with his pants down, not knowing what to do exactly in this situation. From the very beginning, people were very upset and angry on the ground after they saw a young man unarmed laying in the ground for 4.5 hours. And the first thing that happened was that there was an excessive use of law enforcement by St. Louis County initially. Then on day two, there was looting by outsiders, and that should have really awakened the governor. On day three, a senator, myself, was tear gassed for 3 hours, and the governor still did not respond. On day two of the tear gassing, the governor came to the St. Louis area, not Ground Zero, and for 5 minutes he spoke and then he left. On Wednesday, we were tear gassed yet again, and he was at the state fair. And when the world discovered that people were being treated as if they were militants in Afghanistan, that is when Governor Nixon woke up and realized that the world was watching him and his leadership.
Though that does raise the argument, okay, if I screwed up so badly last time, I'm going to be preemptive and definitely show that I'm, you know, focused and on duty in advance of what the grand jury might report. How do you respond to that?
Well, you have to understand that the group of people that I represent have been experiencing trauma for a very long time prior to Michael Brown. And I think part of the governor's response, one, should have been cultural understanding. From the very beginning, many of my constituents felt alarmed that such excessive use was needed. We have had peaceful protest all along. We have self-policed. We have gotten rid of people who were trying to get into the crowds and cause trouble for not only protesters, but police officers. And so when the governor made the announcement, when he signed the executive order to reinstate the state of emergency, my constituents felt very angered because they were being treated and are being treated as if they are militants or insurgents.
Would you have alternatively supported the governor being much quieter on the question of law enforcement tactics and much stronger on the question of let's keep the peace and let's remind ourselves of the cultural sensitivity and the racial tensions that exist in Ferguson? Could he have done something along those lines? Or is it possible that there's really nothing that Governor Nixon could have done because he's so compromised at this point?
Well, honestly, I have to say every time the governor opens his mouth, he digs a deeper hole. When he gave his press conference last week, he sounded like the authority on the side of police officers, very insensitive towards the needs of the people that I represent. He has had zero compassion, zero passion for the emotional needs of the people on the ground. Many of my constituents are experiencing PTSD at this point. We have not had any counselors on the ground from day one. There are a few. Many ministers are serving the role, but he has always been very forceful on the law enforcement side. And I recognize that he is the former attorney general of the state of Missouri. However, I feel as though being in that previous position, one, he should not have instituted a curfew, and two, he should not have instituted a 5-second rule when it came to protesting. Mm-hmm. He, of all people, should have known that the First Amendment right is the right of all natural-born citizens in the United States.
So in the heat of passion during the worst violence back in the summer, you, as far as I can tell, tweeted, F you, Governor, I'm calling your BS. And
yes.
I'm wondering if those sentiments still feel strong with you or if you regret those as a public official.
I absolutely do not regret those words. Because of the situation and where we were, it called for that kind of language to get his attention. For him to carry on as if everything were okay is not justified whatsoever. He has been uncomfortable with the minority community for his entire career, and what he should have done is to go to ground zero like other leaders did and talk to the people who were on the ground who were hurting. But he literally did not go to ground zero until day 15. So even in his executive order for the state of emergency, he's responding to protesting, and I'm glad it took 100 days for him to figure out that he must uphold the First Amendment. But what he doesn't understand is why people are out in the summer and in the frigid cold protesting. They're out there because there has been institutional racism, not only among some police departments in the state of Missouri, but quite frankly, there is institutional racism in the state of Missouri as well as in the Democratic Party here in the state of Missouri.
Do you have any reason to feel optimistic about the outcome, whatever it is, from the grand jury?
You know, my heart, I have to tell you, I've looked at the facts that have been open to us in the press. I do feel like there should be an indictment in my heart. But I know the reality. The reality is that most cases that have gone before the grand jury in a situation like this did not result in an indictment. So I have to prepare myself and my constituents for that. But in my heart, I feel as though there will be an indictment.
Maria Chappelle Nadal is a senator from the Missouri State Senate. She's a Democrat. Thank you very much, Maria.
Thank you so much.
The Ebola crisis has deeply affected West African culture in how the dead are treated, displays of affection are avoided, and the nature of family caring and responsibility have all been deeply disrupted. So it makes sense that African culture would try and come to the rescue of people so threatened by a virus.
We are just cleaning.
From the messes of the war. We just cleaning from the messes of the war. Here comes Ebola as a stumbling block. Let's get together as a walking force. Don't get defeated. You should stand up and fight. Fight this Ebola.
As Ruben Karoma, founding member of Sierra Leone's Refugees All-Star Band, you're hearing there. Marco Werman, host of PRI's The World. Welcome, Marco.
Hi, John. How are you?
So African musicians, often heard on your program, are mobilizing their art and popularity to rally people and deliver messages to fight Ebola. What have you seen and heard?
Well, it's pretty extraordinary on both sides of the Atlantic. Ruben Caroma, as you just played there, founding member of the Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars, they were on a tour of the U.S. back in April, completed their tour in September, and were about to go back to Sierra Leone, and their families said, stay there, really. It's too dangerous. You can do a lot more good by doing a few gigs, raising some money, and sending it back to us, because we're basically locked in our homes. We can't leave. We can't go to the market. That's kind of the encouragement from the government. Stay home. Don't move about and spread this disease. So Ruben and the other members of the band are in a friend's house, actually a friend from Liberia down in Providence, Rhode Island. I went down to see them a few weeks ago, and yeah, I mean, they are now no longer war refugees, which is how the band's first formed after during the Sierra Leone Civil War. They're now Ebola refugees in the U.S. So on top of trying to get some gigs, they're also thinking about this disease and writing songs about it. And what you just heard was kind of a scratch recording of a track that they are going to probably start playing pretty soon, but that's kind of still in the composition phase.
And so many other bands are doing the same thing, and really not only, you know, sort of speaking from their own experience as refugees, as you described there, but also reacting to the kind of Western-oriented ritual of pop music and charity. How has that sort of been also a motivator here?
Well, if you look at this kind of supergroup of Afropop stars that just recorded the song called Africa Stop Ebola, I mean, that's a great example of singers, artists from countries surrounding the three main affected Ebola countries, so Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. You've got Chiken Dja Fakoly, who is a big reggae star in Ivory Coast, Amadou and Mariam from Mali, the blind couple of Mali, Sia Tolno, who is a wonderful singer who is actually from Guinea, and Salif Keita, the great Malian chanteur. So they're all together, a bunch of other people as well, rappers from Senegal and Guinea. And what you get here is a song that actually is not even available on U.S. iTunes right now. It's available only in Europe. But they worked with a linguist in London and came up with a song that addresses these problems. So it's actually, it's musically terrific, and it also has great practical advice on trust your doctors, wash your hands, avoid shaking hands with others. I think it's a huge, huge song.
So it's my understanding that this song will eventually be sold on iTunes, and the profits will go to MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, which is hard at work in the Ebola crisis zone. How different is this in approach and in, I guess, the kind of artists used from the Bob Geldof kinds of, you know, help out Africa with songs recorded in London?
Well, it's really different, John. I mean, I really felt like what Bob Geldof did was kind of an easy way to raise some quick money, but it feels kind of tone deaf to what's going on in West Africa. So I don't know if you've seen the video to this new version of Do They Know It's Christmas? So they've taken the old song from 30 years ago written by Bob Geldof and Midge Ure, and honestly, in my opinion, it was never a great tune, and some of the lyrics just don't stand up to the kind of Ebola retread. So there's a line, there's no need to be afraid. Well, guys, actually, there is a real need to be afraid, because if you're in Monrovia and you're exposed, you could die. So the video starts with a shot of men in hazmat suits going into this woman's house somewhere in West Africa. They carry her off a stained mattress to her presumably lonely burial, and then suddenly it cuts to this clean, mostly white, wealthy group of singers in this room doing their part, quote-unquote. And, you know, Geldof has been answering some of these points in the British press with pretty colorful language, saying he doesn't really care what the critics say. So it's kind of a tough way to go about raising money. All that said, the song is already at number one on the UK charts,
wow.
And that's just after a week. It's the fastest-selling single in the UK so far this year. I mean, you know, in terms of just raising money, it's great. I think it's kind of a cynical way to do it, but I guess, you know, Band-Aid Trust will disperse that money wisely.
Well, he's got a point, and money, if not maybe cultural sensitivity. Let's hear one last song before we go.
It's time to protect yourself. Protect your family. Protect your community. Because Ebola is here. It's real. It's time to protect yourself.
Who is this, Marco?
This is Ebola is Real, courtesy of Hot FM in Monrovia. It's tuned by three Liberian singers. Who are there? F.A., Solfresh, and Denji. And to me, these guys, all of the music coming out of Monrovia, and I haven't heard a lot coming out of Sierra Leone, but Monrovia musicians have really kind of stepped up and realized with that song. We spoke with them back in May on The World, the guys from Hot FM. They're messaging to the people and explaining to them how to beat Ebola. You know, again, it's about don't shake your friend's hands, wash your hands, be careful. They serve a practical purpose. By the time we checked back with Hot FM in September, the music and messaging was so successful that they had changed format to basically all Ebola news, music, and info 24/7. And they worked with the UN, another tune. Again, it's not like terribly deep lyrics, but they serve a real purpose. It's messaging and kind of using music to beat the disease. It's really impressive.
And while the Geldof money is certainly welcome, these messages here are probably longer lasting and certainly speak much more directly to the cultural devastation that's taken place as a result of Ebola, almost a healing effort straight from the music.
Yeah, and not only that, but like the genre has now evolved in the course of 7 months. So there's this group or a singer, Tantan B, who came out with like a lover's rock version called State of Emergency, which is just totally incongruous. When you hear the opening lines, it's like this ought to be on, you know, The Quiet Storm, but it's all about Ebola.
Marco Werman is host of PRI's The World. Thanks so much.
Great to speak with you, John.
Got my gloves on my hands, but tonight for a different reason.
Before we go, following the tradition of presidents of both parties, Barack Obama will offer his own executive order to address immigration reform. What do you think about this?
Hi, my name is Elisa Castillo, and I'm calling from Rio Vista, Texas. I believe that if they have been here their entire lives, because they were born here, because their parents came here illegally, my opinion is that they should be returned. I understand that they're having hardships in their country, but our economy can only handle so many immigrants.
You can be a part of this conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway or call 877-8MYTAKE. And at thetakeaway.org, you can catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program at any time. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Now the time of danger. State of emergency. Only God can save us. This is not a joke. This is not for fun. I seen a mother cry. She just lost her son. Think I can help her, cause she needs a ride. But then my baby warned me. Help.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.